This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Jesse Reynolds, who's the program director at the Center for Genetics and Society. Welcome to California Politics Today. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about the Center for Genetics and Society, where it comes from, what its mission is.
Okay, the Center for Genetics and Society is a research, education, and advocacy nonprofit organization advocating for the responsible use of new human genetic and reproductive technologies. Specifically in regard to Proposition 71, we're a supporter of embryonic stem cell research and its public funding, and of course we're also we support a woman's right to choose. But we opposed Proposition 71, not in principle to the whole concept, but instead we had a range of concerns, which I elaborated in my last interview, having to do with public oversight, with the nature of the patents and the royalties, with protection of human subjects, particularly the women who would be donating eggs for this research. And as Proposition 71 is now being implemented, and the first meeting of the governing committee is scheduled for this Friday, our concerns have deepened for a few reasons that I can get into.
Sure. That governing committee is called the ICOC.
Yeah, the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee, which has a certain Orwellian ring to it because it's not independent and there's no true citizens, independent citizens' voices on the committee.
So what are your concerns as that committee gears up to get started on Friday, 2 days from now?
Well, yeah. Three things come to mind that have developed in the last couple of weeks. What's been in the news much is that State Senator Deborah Ortiz, who is one of Prop 71's key backers, is now has herself acknowledged many of the defects of Prop 71 and has introduced legislation to supplement Prop 71 and to create some more oversight and reform.
That's SB 18.
SB 18, yes.
Right. This is essentially to oversee the overseers, I guess.
Yeah. The bill seems to be that she's doing her best. It's limited because the initiative explicitly says that the legislature cannot intervene in the first 3 years, and then after that, it would require a 70% supermajority. This is one of the things we were concerned about. Prop
right.
71.
Is it your view that those provisions are ironclad enough, and that whatever Senator Ortiz proposes or the legislature may pass is going to be a moot point, given the provisions in the initiative itself?
No. I think there's some possibilities for a couple of reasons. I just heard her she was on a radio show, and she said that her legal counsel has said that there is room for the legislature to pass supplemental legislation. And the bill itself has three parts, one of which does directly amend the section of California's code that came from Proposition 71. That I do think may or may not pass legal muster. That's a little tricky.
Right.
The other two sections don't explicitly say anything to do with Prop 71. They amend different sections of the code, but they would impact Prop 71. One has to do with regulating women's donations of eggs for research and fertility treatments, and that applies to all such egg donation in the state.
Right. Now, what's your organization's view on that, and does do the provisions in Senator Ortiz's bill sufficiently address your concerns?
I certainly think that those provisions come pretty close. What our bill is doing is trying to exclude a commercial market in the eggs, and it also directs the State Department of Health to derive some guidelines for a more thorough and independent structure of informed consent for the women donating these eggs.
Beyond informed consent, does Senator Ortiz's legislation allow women to be paid bounties for their eggs?
You know, I'm not sure on that point. I know that the language says that the eggs cannot be bought or sold.
Right.
And my understanding is that would probably limit the amount of reimbursement that a woman could receive. It would limit it to some direct expenses.
But there's essentially a difference whether there's a resale market in the eggs,
right,
or whether the women can be compensated for their time, trouble, inconvenience, or anything beyond that.
Right, and of course we're concerned that even language that says that these women can only be reimbursed for their inconvenience.
Right.
Well, you know, as you go down the socioeconomic ladder, there are women who might see just a few thousand dollars of reimbursement for inconvenience to be critical when she's trying to you know, pay the basic bills and put food on the table.
Or unless
there is still the possibility of economic coercion,
or unless they decide that inconvenience is in the eye of the beholder, and
exactly.
People in lower socioeconomic status have less to be inconvenienced about, and therefore can be paid less or whatever.
Exactly. If you imagine a $2,000 payment, just to pick a hypothetical number,
right?
Wealthy women are not going to go down that path,
right?
If I can move on,
sure.
to the second concern, is that the way that the ICOC was structured is that 27 of the members were to be appointed by 6 elected officials,
right?
And five UC chancellors would get some appointees as well.
No partridges in pear trees, though. I think.
No, but it does make for some pretty complicated reading. And but then the chair and the vice chair, there would be 4 nominations for each of those positions made by California's 4 top elected officials.
Right.
And for the chair position, they all nominated the same person. And if that wasn't strange enough, they nominated the person who largely wrote Proposition 71, who was the chairman of the Yes on 71 campaign and the largest donor to the Yes on 71.
This is Robert Klein.
Yes, Robert Klein. And you know, it just does not seem feasible that that an extensive search for the most qualified candidate was done in such a short time, and that they all came up with the same nominee.
Do you know if all 4 of those? That's the governor, lieutenant governor,
treasurer, and controller.
Right.
Yes, all 4 nominated. Robert Klein.
So the ballot's going to say Robert Klein, Robert Klein, Robert Klein, Robert Klein.
Exactly. I mean, the committee does have some room to negotiate. They could. There's nothing to prevent them from rejecting Robert Klein.
Right.
From abstaining or from voting no.
So we get two yes votes. One. Who all is going to vote on that? The 27 committee members.
Yes, the 27 out of the 29 committee members who have been appointed.
Does he need a majority of those votes, or a plurality, or?
I believe he needs a majority of those votes.
Okay.
So there is the possibility of an abstention. I mean, the law says that the first meeting will be convened in order to elect a chairman, but it does not legislate that a chairman must be elected then.
Okay, so what's the position, or has your group taken a position on the on how unfair this is, or how inappropriate it is that only one candidate has been nominated?
Well, the center is does not find this acceptable at all. As I said, it just seems unlikely that an extensive, thorough search was done for such a powerful position. This is the person who's going to be in charge for 6 years of managing billions of dollars of California taxpayers' money.
Right. Now, I read a statement from Mr. Klein yesterday in which he abjures all possible conflicts of interest and ownership of any stock in any biotechnology company, et cetera. Is that a disclaimer that's sufficiently powerful for you to override any of your other concerns?
Well, I'm still skeptical. It's easy to say I, as an individual, will not hold any biotech stock, but for example, take this for example. I was reading an article that said that in the 80s, Robert Klein's consulting company was consulting for the county board of supervisors for Fresno County,
right,
about how to create some housing, some affordable housing of some type.
Right.
And at the same time, unbeknownst to the county board of supervisors, his same consulting firm was consulting for the construction companies who were to receive those bonds.
That sounds a lot like being nominated by four people for the same office.
Exactly. It just doesn't sound right. It's just not right. And there's rumblings among the members of the ICOC that they're not happy with whether it's client or not, just the fact that all four of the nominations came out to be the same.
Why don't we back off, look at this a little higher up. Is this kind of situation, which already seems kind of unique and weird, indicative of the kind of situations that you were worried that the passage of Prop 71 would generate?
Well, exactly. We were concerned that, for example, that by shutting out the legislature in such a way that there would be no oversight, or there would be very little room to amend some of these things. We were concerned that, for example, the qualifications for the chair that were spelled out in Prop 71 did seem to resemble Robert Klein's resume a little too much in terms of experience with issuing bonds and so forth.
Right.
And so, yeah, we're concerned that
it was essentially writing a job description or a contract or a request for proposal that really could only be filled by one person or one company.
It seems that way. And then when you look at the members of the board of the committee, there's very few voices there who have advocated for the concerns of the disenfranchised, of the poor, of people of color, of women's reproductive health, and the voices of the citizens. Most of the people have spent their lives close in connections with large, powerful institutions, serving on the board of the UC Regents and chancellors of universities of California.
One of them, in fact, was married to a former governor.
Well, there's a perfect example, and so those diverse voices that represent this huge state that we have are just not present.
Okay, now before we focus on your third concern, let's look at this on an even broader level. Is this sort of bearing out your concerns, or your organization's concerns, that a new mechanism has been created here, or a precedent for a new mechanism whereby a small group of people with a particular agenda use, say, $30 million to pass an initiative that's a constitutional amendment that authorizes the expenditures of hundreds of times in excess of their initial investment on the part of public funds, privatizes the profit, socializes the risk, and excludes any other government agency or public group from participating in the decisions going forward?
Yeah, I think it really spells out a lot of the concerns that we have, and I think that we very much welcome the concerns that are now being expressed by Senator Ortiz, and hope to hear that other previous supporters of Prop 71 do begin to realize these deep flaws. At first acknowledging these, and then second, moving forward to repair them the best that we can.
Okay, we're going to get into the repair in a minute. Go into your third concern.
Well, just the nature of the meeting itself. So the meeting is scheduled for Friday, the first meeting of the ICOC.
Where's it going to be?
It's going to be held on the campus of UCSF in San Francisco.
Okay.
And someone who's interested can find out the details at the state treasurer's office. The meeting is being convened by the treasurer and the controller's office.
Okay.
So the details are at Phil Angelides' website. But the nature of the agenda of the meeting is posted in such a way that it, in a way, it sort of spells out the agenda as a fait accompli. Not only is public comment the public comment period at the end of the meeting instead of during or even before the meeting.
As the Red Queen says, verdict first, trial later.
Exactly, but there's so many agenda items for a 3-hour meeting that it looks like they're just going to whip through and select the chair and select the vice chair and swear them in, form a hiring committee, form policies on government and ethics, and begin a search for staff. All of that in 3 hours, and it just doesn't seem that there can be effective deliberation.
Unless, of course, they've already deliberated.
That's our concern.
Or if they had deliberated before they even put the initiative out for signature.
And I spoke with a committee member yesterday, and he said that they have not received any background materials on the nominees for chair and vice chair. There's actually three different nominees for vice chair, thankfully, right. But they haven't received any in-depth CV, resume, and background information on these candidates.
Sounds a little like Congress passing a 9,000-page bill without having read it.
Yeah, that seems to happen a little too often. And a colleague of ours, an advisor, is Charles Halpern, who has had a, you know, he's a former president of the Nathan Cummings Foundation and the founding dean of the CUNY Law School.
Right. And, I'm sorry, which law school?
CUNY, City University of New York.
Oh, okay, right.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
He's sending a letter. He sent it actually yesterday to Attorney General Lockyer, saying that the structure of the meeting on Friday violates the Keene-Bagley Open Meeting Act on four different counts.
Right.
And thus actually carrying out the meeting would be illegal, and that the actual committee members could be held responsible for misdemeanor charges if the meeting goes forward.
What's the status of that? It's a letter to Attorney General Lockyer right now?
Yes, it's a letter to Attorney General Lockyer sent by Charles Halpern.
Maybe after we go off the air, you can get me a copy of it or connect me to him and we can talk as well.
Yeah. I can certainly do that. I've seen an earlier draft of the letter.
Okay.
And the letter today is going to be going out to the committee members.
Now, are you in touch enough to know with the committee members enough to know whether blocks are forming already or whether everyone is on board going rah rah for Robert Klein or what the internal politics of the board membership is at this point?
Yeah, we're doing our best to see how that's going to shape up. But we don't know much more than what has been reported so far in the papers, and a couple of the board members have expressed their support for Klein. I've only found one who has publicly, with his name, been expressed discomfort with the nomination of Klein.
Who was that?
That was Jeff Sheehy.
And where is he coming from?
Who is he is he works at the UC San Francisco. I'm not going to have the full title right, but the AIDS Research Center. He was the designated representative of a patient advocacy group for AIDS. He was the one person appointed by outgoing Senate President John Burton.
Well, more of his legacy lingers on, I guess.
Yes, yes.
I interviewed Deborah Berger about 2 days ago. She's the president of the California Nurses Association.
Yes.
She sort of focused on the fact that it was going to be pretty hard to get anything legislated in light of the initiative's ironclad protections against mm-hmm. that. But she suggested that Senator Ortiz and presumably other people who share her concerns approach the ICOC itself and suggest to them that it's within their power to make the changes that SB 18 would, and that they should just ask them to do that. What's your view of that strategy?
No, I think it's a wonderful idea, and the center is happy to join with Ms. Berger and call upon the IC to voluntarily adopt stricter standards.
Could they do that if they wanted to?
They can absolutely do that. The Prop 71 says that, for example, certain meetings of the ICOC, and particularly its powerful working groups, are not covered by the Public Records Act and the open meeting laws.
And financial disclosure rules also?
And there's also a little bit about the financial disclosure, but there is nothing preventing the ICOC from adopting a policy of increased transparency and increased responsibility and more interaction with the legislature voluntarily that would not contradict the letter of propositions, the letter of the law of Proposition 71.
So essentially, having been impaneled with the powers that they have, there's nothing to constrain them from constraining themselves if they want to.
Correct. And I think that would be the responsible move, and I hope that the members of the committee can set things off on this better tone.
Could we focus on that a little bit about the transparency issues on financial disclosure, open meetings, conflicts of interest? What would the Center for Genetics and Society like to see the standard be in those areas?
Well, I think, for example, where to begin? I think the working groups is a good example.
Right. Tell people what the working groups are and how important they are.
There's three working groups. and there one concerns real estate, one concerns bioethics and standards for human research, and one concerns issuing the grants and reviewing the grant proposals. The law says, well, these working group members are not employees of the state of California, and they are only advisors, so consequently their meetings are not covered by the open meeting laws and the Public Records Act.
Right.
Well, that's a perfect example. Just today on the radio, I believe it was UC Berkeley Chancellor and ICOC member Robert Bergeau said, well, we've got a lot of ground to cover, but the great thing is we're going to have great advice from these working groups. My concern is that all the decisions will be made behind closed doors by these working groups, and then the ICOC will, in its public meetings, rubber stamp those decisions.
Right. Now, do the participants in these working groups need to file financial disclosure forms?
I would assume not. I would assume not. I don't know that specific.
And the substance of their meetings, their criteria for issuing the grants of up to $3 billion over the life of the commission of the ICOC, those are not going to be made public?
Well, I think that is within the latitude of policymaking, of policy decisions. That is, the ICOC could choose to make those criteria more public.
But as the rules now stand, they don't have to.
It doesn't appear so.
Okay.
I mean, if their meetings are not open and their records are not made public, then the only thing that will be made public is what they finally submit as their recommendations to the ICOC itself.
Okay, let me focus on one or two more substantive issues, and then I want to wrap up by talking about where your group is, what you're planning on doing to affect the changes that you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
We touched on it briefly, something I'm calling egg farming.
Mm-hmm.
What are the issues there, and how open to abuse do you think the system is right now?
Well, to do the type of research that the advocates of Prop 71 say has the most potential, and at the scale that $3 billion would create, the researchers are going to need probably thousands and thousands of human eggs. Now, there are technical possibilities about how, at a future date, researchers might be able to get around that, but that's not the case right now. Where do these eggs come from? The only way we can get human eggs is from human women. And this is the process of extracting eggs is painful and invasive, and it involves taking drugs that have possible negative side effects. And
does the current wording of the law exclude liability for any of these agencies for consequential damages following these fertility treatments? Are they exempt from normal liability law if these women suffer ill effects?
I don't think the actual law says that. I may be wrong.
Okay.
But I suspect that in this day and age of concern about liability, I imagine that the egg donors would have to sign a waiver of medical liability form.
Meaning that in exchange for whatever compensation they get, they voluntarily, in quotes, waive their right to bring litigation against whomever for any subsequent damages that they suffer on the basis of those treatments?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we have a situation where there's a great demand for eggs, and this is not something that many women, just for the sake of moving scientific research forward, a few will certainly, but thousands of women will come forward and take large amounts of hormones and have invasive surgical procedures performed to extract these eggs.
This is something that happens for individual women who are highly motivated to have children who can't do it otherwise.
Right. No, exactly, women who are undergoing in vitro fertilization.
Right.
And for an example of where SB 18, Senator Ortiz's bill, might come up a little short, and this is that based upon a suggestion of our colleague Judy Norsegian of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. She says that the only ethical way to move forward with such large-scale egg donations is to limit it, if I'm going to try to get this right, and I might be just a hair off, but to limit it so that women who are undergoing IVF anyway have one or two extra eggs extracted at that time.
This would tend to take the burden off the poor and put it on the upper middle class, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Okay.
It would, and it would remove any sort of sense of financial or social coercion for people to undergo egg donation just to supply the eggs for biomedical research.
Okay, I think we've covered that. Two other questions that have to do directly with money. There are no provisions there were no provisions in Prop 71 saying that any treatments or cures or therapies developed through the $3 billion or $6 billion, depending on how you look at it, are to be given to poor people who can't afford it otherwise, and that there's no reason why they can't just be priced at $200,000 per treatment and only be made available to people with either really good insurance or really high net worth. What does Senator Ortiz's bill do to in that regard, and what does the Center for Genetics and Society feel would be the appropriate way of dealing with the availability of whatever treatments are developed through this with this money to the medically indigent or otherwise people who are not really wealthy or have really good health insurance?
Right. We expressed concern that this type of research, stem cell therapies in general, and specifically those derived from research cloning, or also called somatic cell nuclear transfer, would involve an enormous amount of lab work and clinical work to develop a custom therapy tissue for each individual patient.
Right.
Either that could come out to be very expensive, and we were concerned that this would amount to a state subsidy for high-end treatments for the wealthy.
Because, in fact, that's the essence of the something that's already known about the structure of how the treatments would work, this kind of personalization of medicine.
Right. Now, the advocates claim that as this is developed and it's made more routine, the price would greatly plummet.
Right.
And please let me be clear that I and the center hope that these treatments pan out, and we hope that there are major advances in debilitating diseases such as Parkinson's and diabetes
in treating them, you mean?
Treating them, yes, absolutely. And we hope that these are widely accessible and made affordable. But we're concerned that Prop 71 doesn't lend itself to that. Now, SB 18, the third provision, I said there's two of the provisions that are laws that are sort of outside of Prop 71, regulating the entire state, including Prop 71. Now, the third provision is one of those, and what it says is that any biomedical research funded by the state of California would be made available to the low-income residents of California, particularly those on state insurance programs, at affordable rates.
Okay, now that applies to if the legislature passes a bill tomorrow to put $100,000 into some kind of research, then it would apply to that.
Right.
Has Prop 71 protected itself against that kind of constraint, though?
Well, I'm not a lawyer,
right,
but I don't see how. It's tricky. There's a statement in Prop 71 in a couple of places where it says this proposition will be exempt from current and future state and federal legislation, basically as the ICOC sees fit.
Right.
And my layman's interpretation is that this is certainly flirting with unconstitutionality.
To say you can't change the law, you can't affect us later by any
way. Well, not only that, this is going beyond saying you can't modify Prop 71. It's saying that if the state government passes a law regulating egg donation in general,
right,
or research developments from public funds in general, with no reference to Prop 71
right,
and the ICOC, that the ICOC and the Institute for Regenerative Medicine and just be exempt from that.
That essentially says they are the state. That says that they are
a state. That they are.
They're a sovereign. They become a sovereign territory in essence.
In a certain format, yes. Now, Prop 71, of course, could be completely revoked and modified by another initiative or by another state constitutional amendment that would trump Prop 71.
So that would only require a majority. It would need to be qualified under the provisions of a state constitutional amendment, but it would only need a majority, a vote of the people to pass it, right?
Right. We would see another. We could see another state initiative.
Do you think that this could eventually or soon reach that point where the accretion of problems generated another initiative campaign, or do the only people who have the $30-35 million necessary to do that are the people who put it in the first place, and be hard to get everyone organized to do it the other way, considering how little money they had to spend against Prop 71 the first time?
Well, I hope we can see another initiative. To me, that's the only feasible way out of this problem. And you bring up the disparity in funds, and I suspect that an initiative to reform Prop 71 would not see the type of large-scale donations by wealthy individuals and venture capitalists that the Yes on 71 campaign.
Although it would probably see those donations to oppose it, wouldn't it?
It very well might, but okay. At the same time, big money doesn't always win. And although I'm often a cynic, I'm often also an optimist in that there are many instances where the will of the people can override the will of large concentrated sources of money.
Okay, speaking of large concentrations of money, let's focus on one more point and then wrap up with your plans. Arrangements for the assuming that this research leads to treatments that generate a lot of profit, who's going to get it and that profit, and what arrangements are there in Prop 71 about the allocation of that profit, and what does Senator Ortiz want to do in that regard, and how does that correspond to what the Center for Genetics and Society would like to see happen?
Right. The division of profits from a patented discovery are usually made in the forms of royalties.
Right.
The language of Prop 71 the division of royalties between the state and the recipient of the grant, which keep in mind could be a private for-profit company, or it could be the University of California.
Right.
Could run that whole spectrum, but the language of Prop 71 does not favor the state very much. It says something about balancing the state's desire to recoup its cost versus the need for the research institution or company to stimulate further research.
Right.
It's feasible that 100% of the royalties could go to the recipient of the grant.
Are there provisions in Prop 71 or in SB 18 regarding sort of the priority of those profits paying off the bonds that generated the research that created the treatment that made the profit?
Right. Well, I don't know of any such provision in Prop 71 itself. And
right.
What Senator Ortiz's bill does, SB 18, in the part that is in the third part, the same part that I mentioned earlier, that's regulating state-funded biomedical research in general, not specifically Prop 71. So this is one of the parts that I feel could probably stand a constitutional challenge. Is it says it strengthens the language that for the state's favor. It says that the balance of royalties, the state should receive a portion of the royalties commensurate with its contribution.
Right, because you think at least that the funding that the state puts in, it ought to get back, rather, especially if, let's say it's invested $100 million in something, which generates $1 billion in profit.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem that at least $100 million ought to come off the top of that profit to pay back the investment of the state, rather than have the state out for that money and the recipients of that profit get more than $900 million and get even some of the money that was invested
right.
In the first place.
Now, the advocates of Prop 71 said that in the long run it would not only be self-financing, but through the royalties and through the reduction in health care costs, it would actually financially benefit the state and state government. And we were skeptical, partially because of the way that the language around royalties SB18 is a big step in the right direction towards that, and it does contain a provision that says those royalties will be used to pay off the bonds, any bonds that were issued to fund that research.
Okay, one other thing about the bonds, the figure that was bandied about during the campaign, although not bandied about much by the proponents, was that the $3 billion in investment is going to cost the state $6 billion
right.
to pay off. That's at current interest rates. The Fed just raised interest rates a quarter of a point yesterday and promises to keep doing that on a steady course for the foreseeable future. Is it possible that if interest rates for any number of macroeconomic reasons end up skyrocketing or just continuing to go up, that $6 billion figure could rapidly start approaching $8 or $10 billion?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not only that, but the proponents of Prop 71 were using some sort of a, I suppose I would call it an accounting sleight of hand, saying that they were basically, I don't know, like a TV salesman would advertise. They were saying 5 years, same as cash.
Right.
They were saying there'd be no payments for the first 5 years. However, they do need to make interest payments on those bonds during those first 5 years, and that will be coming out of its annual. Of its annual budget. And you do a little math and you can see that at a certain point up to a third of its annual of its annual expenditures could go towards financing the previous year's bonds. And that's just after 5 years, but when it's not even paying off the principal, when it's just floating along at interest-only payments.
Right. Okay. So, I think we've covered a lot of the substance here. Let's summarize what's the Center for Genetics and Society's position right now about the formation of the ICOC, and what kind of concrete steps are you going to be taking to publicize and try to implement your preferences in this area?
Well, in the short term, within 48 hours or so from right now, the ICOC will be holding its first meeting, and we hope that the members of the committee will act responsibly and reject the nomination of Robert Klein, not only because of his possible personal conflicts, but simply by receiving unanimous nominations, that they don't have the time to, they don't have the range to review appropriate candidates. They could, for example, as our colleague Charles Halpern has recommended, appoint him on an interim basis, 90 days, and then a true search is done for an appropriate candidate. We also call upon the members of the committee to hold themselves to higher standards of ethics, of transparency, and public accountability than is mandated by Prop 71. They have the choice to do that. They also have the choice to cooperate with the legislature, and the legislature, one step removed, does represent quite often the will of the people, and I hope that they can work with Senator Ortiz and create some sense of reform.
And if they either arrogantly refuse to listen or do anything, or put forward some kind of plan that attempts to look good but really doesn't go to the substance, what kind of steps are you and other groups contemplating as a way of moving forward in the direction you'd like to see it go?
Well, that's a question that's very much on our mind these days. Things have been moving so fast. This past, of course, just about 6 weeks ago, and the first meeting is already upon us, and we have not developed a longer-term strategy. But we do hope, we're going to spend some more time reviewing Senator Ortiz's bill in more depth, take a position on it, and hopefully be in communication with her offices, with her office about changes we'd like to see. We have a number of allies, not only in what we call the Pro-Choice Alliance Against 71, of which we were a member, but as Senator Ortiz demonstrates, an increasing number of previous advocates of 71 are beginning to see its flaws. And we hope that a number of the committee members will share our concerns, and we look forward to working with people like Ortiz and also committee members to set things straight.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us and to all the people listening about this, and we'll continue to be in touch as the issue evolves.
Thanks, Mark, and if I can just give the obligatory plug for further information.
Please.
The Center for Genetics and Society is on the the web where all sorts of analysis and news about Prop 71 can be found, and we have an electronic newsletter where you can keep updated. We are at www.genetics-and-society.org.
Okay, good. I'll put a link to that on the page as well.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.